for today is 98-0454, Kathy Strozinski versus the School District of Brown Deer. Elizabeth O'Neill will argue for the School District of Brown Deer. Ms. O'Neill?
Thank you. Good afternoon. This case presents two different issues. The first issue is whether the involuntary termination elements of a wrongful discharge claim can be satisfied through allegations of constructive discharge, and whether the tax laws can support a claim for wrongful discharge, whether they are sufficiently stated public policy.
Could you speak up, please? I'm having a little difficulty hearing.
I'm sorry. Under the facts of this case, you don't ever actually have to get to the first question. You can look at the public policy and the facts of this case, the alleged public policy, and that can be the end of the case right there. There are three different federal Internal Revenue Code sections cited to support the public policy, none of which apply, and there is one state statute which does not apply under the facts of this case. The issue for the public policy in this case has to do with tax withholding on wages. Mr. Moe, the superintendent of the school district of Brown Deer, was paid as part of his compensation package a payment into a tax-sheltered annuity. The Internal Revenue Code requires that taxes be withheld from wages at the time that they are paid. When the tax-sheltered annuity payment was made, no taxes were withheld. Ms. Strozinski assumes that a tax-sheltered annuity payment constitute wages under the Internal Revenue Code. It's not that clear. It's an assumption that she makes. But even if they do, the taxes were not withheld at the time that the tax-sheltered annuity payment was made. Ms. Strozinski sought to subsequently rectify what she perceived as a tax deficiency. IRC 3101, 3102, and 6672 do not apply at all to subsequent rectifications.
Am I missing something? This was a summary judgment, was it not?
Yes, it was.
Do we have to assume for purposes of the summary judgment all facts and inferences favorable to Ms. Strozinski?
You do, but you do not have to assume that particular laws which she cites apply to her facts. And that is the distinction, because you have to assume and accept as true all of her allegations about the treatment to which she claims she was subjected by the superintendent, but you do not have to assume that Internal Revenue Code 3101, 3102, and 6672 applied. Those are questions of law.
Now, in her factual content, you know, a summary judgment, it's looking at the facts, and then you look in the light most favorable, and you say, looking at the facts, she was alleging factually, I believe, that she was refusing to falsify, and I think this was used in your opposing counsel's brief on page 2, at least in other places, to falsify the tax records. That was what was in her mind, that she was going to be A, responsible. She called the IRS, and they said that she would be responsible. At least that's what I get out of the... And those are the facts, as Justice Babbage is indicating, that went to the trier of fact, trial court.
But the public... those are the facts that went to the trial court. The public policy issue is whether those tax laws as a group state a sufficiently well-defined matter of public policy to support an exception to the at-will employment doctrine.
And that's a question of law.
And that's a question of law.
Not for the jury.
Not for the jury. And that's what I believe the Court of Appeals assumed without deciding. The Court of Appeals decision says there is a fact question as to whether the conduct to which Ms. Strozinski was subjected constitutes constructive discharge. And there is a fact question as to whether that conduct was triggered by the debate about the withholding on the tax-sheltered annuity check, which would support public policy.
So you're saying we don't get to the constructive discharge because the public policy is not clear, it's not sufficient, and it's needed in order to have your opposing counsel prevail in this case.
Yes, I think that that's the argument can stop at the public policy. The second part of our petition, the second part of our argument, is that it's a complete evisceration of the employment at will rule to let constructive discharge satisfy the involuntary termination element when the constructive discharge is based on allegations of conduct which are not otherwise proscribed by statute. But I don't think this court needs to get to that issue because the tax laws do not contain a sufficiently specific statement of public policy to support a constructive discharge claim.
Ms. O'Neill, what do you think the statutes would have to say in order to state with sufficiency a public policy that would underlie this claim?
The statutes, either within their own language or in the spirit of the statute, have to promote a clear and well-defined standard of conduct for the public good in the mind of the community common sense and common conscience for matters regarding public welfare and paramount requirements of public interest. That's how it's defined in Brockmeyer. And tax laws are, the tax laws at issue here are rules of order. They're like the rules for procedure. They're not substantive issues of the common conscience or the common good. There are rules for the orderly continuation of government and the orderly administration of the collection of revenue for the government.
Well, doesn't the plaintiff attempt to tie those rules from the Internal Revenue Code to 943.39 and say that you have to read them together, and when you read them together, you do have a clear expression of public policy?
The plaintiff tries to make that tie, Your Honor, but I don't think that is a matter of law. It is a sufficient tie or an appropriate tie. 939.43 requires... Did I say that backwards?
Yeah, it's okay. 943.39.
Sorry. A little dyslexic. Requires that there be a fraudulent intent, which there is no indication, even under the best inference for the plaintiff, a fraudulent intent. There is no evidence that Mr. Moe was not going to pay these taxes. The way to correct withholding deficiencies is at the end of the year when you file your 1040 return, if you have underpaid, you write a check.
Well, that's from Mr. Moe's standpoint. But from the standpoint of an employer, you have an obligation to withhold. And if you don't withhold, and then there's no payment, you are personally liable. Having been through that, I understand that, and you do too.
And that goes back to the IRC, though, and under 943, I don't believe that there's evidence of the intent to defraud.
Well, even if there was no intent to defraud, your argument is that it doesn't cover you because you're not a corporation or a limited liability company, right?
Correct.
No.
So that would not cover you just on its face.
That's our position, yes.
But what about the spirit of it?
Under the spirit of it, again, I don't think that there's evidence to show that the intent to defraud. We were not asking her to not report that he made the TSA account, and his W-2 would have reflected that he did.
But the whole tax system in this country rests on withholding. I've overstated that because of its interest and dividends, et cetera. That's not withheld, but for employment and salary, it is. And that is just a basic tenet. And if you didn't have withholding, the government wouldn't get its money. And the cost of collecting it would be stupendous.
That's true. That's very true. But there are all kinds of elements of compensation in the course of employment which are not subjected to withholding. Money you put in your 401k is wages, but it is not subjected to withholding. It is not clear that the tax-sheltered annuity payment would have been subjected to withholding.
Well, she made checks and attempted to find out, and her best information was it was.
But under the public policy, I mean, her best information was that it was, but under the public policy argument, I don't think it is a sufficiently clear statement of the common good, particularly because even if we assume that taxes should have been withheld, they should have been withheld under the tax-sheltered annuity payment in July 7th, and they weren't. And if that was a mistake, that was a mistake. There is not a law that she cited, and there's not a public policy that she cited, that then what you have to do is in the next check make up the deficiency.
And that's what she tried to do because the computer software was not set up so that you could take this out of the TSA, which was his bonus check that went to Janice. So what she was trying to do was to take this out of the, as you said, the next check.
That's right.
And that, I have a question. Just, we've dealt, this court, at least I've been on for 8 years, and we've dealt with a couple of cases, Houseman, Kemper, one that I'm very familiar with, one dealing with a nursing home, one dealing with a CDL, commercial driver's license, which where the employer said, look, you drive the truck. The man said, I don't have a commercial license. He said, I don't care whether you have one or not. You take the truck out, which was clearly violating the law. What your argument seems to be is that because it is not clear here, because there is no well-defined statute, I know the Chief Justice is asking, well, isn't it, it should be clear that you have to withhold taxes, Social Security, etc. How important is it that Mr. Osman, the immediate supervisor of Straczynski, signed a document saying, I take full responsibility? You think that makes any difference? Because under the statute, it says, I'm talking about 943.39, Director Baba, or an employee, but you're saying that doesn't meet it because it's not a corporation and it's not a limited liability company. So you're saying in no way does this fit under the Internal Revenue Code. Is that?
I'm saying I don't believe that this fits under 943.39, but I do believe that Mr. Edmondson's signature on that document saying you will not be held responsible is very significant, because even if we assume or even if you find that the tax laws support or state a sufficiently well-defined statement of public policy to support a claim for wrongful discharge, the law very clearly requires the employee has to refuse the command, and she didn't. She didn't want to until somebody told her, okay, you're not going to get in trouble. And once they said, you won't be in trouble, she did it. And the record does reflect that in the end analysis, the check was issued with all the withholding anyway, because Mr. Moe decided that he probably ought to have all the withholding done, and the last check issued at the end of the day contained the withholding for his regular pay period and withholding for his TSA check. So it is very significant that he signed that, because she did not refuse the command. So her efforts to take the withholding in the first place, which were done on her own initiative, were merely praiseworthy. They might be extremely praiseworthy, but they're not sufficient under the law for wrongful discharge in the state.
I must miss something. You said she did not refuse the command. I thought in the facts initially the check then was issued without withholding, and then that was made up.
But she issued the check not because she was afraid she was going to break the law. Once she issued the check without the withholding, a full amount, it was after Mr. Edmondson signed a piece of paper saying, okay, you won't be responsible. And once she got that, she issued the check. So she didn't refuse the command.
No, she adhered to breaking the law, potentially.
Right. But that's a very important fact, because public policy exceptions to the at-will employment rule require you to refuse the command, and in Houseman, it was an implicit command.
No. It could be considered it seemed to me that a text in the Houseman said that it could be considered an implicit command, but I don't think the opinion went that way. Now, I could be wrong, so I'm sorry.
No, that's the opinion said that the opinion in Houseman found that the implicit command was not enough. They found public policy based on the affirmative reporting duty and the compliance with the affirmative reporting duty. But it is a significant distinction, because even the explicit command in Houseman was insufficient. And in this case, she didn't refuse the command. She didn't ignore the directive.
No, but she made a fuss, right?
Yes, she did make a fuss.
And made a fuss so much that she asks a colleague to put it in writing, because she obviously doesn't trust him.
Yes.
And that doesn't create goodwill.
That's right.
And her allegation is that it creates very bad will, to the point where they don't fire her, but they make life so miserable she's got to quit.
That's
and
right.
all because she stood her ground on not violating the tax law. I mean, that's the putting it in plain words, right? She takes a stand. She doesn't want to violate the law. They say, go ahead and violate. This is from her perspective. They say, go ahead and violate it. She says, no. They say, okay, we're going to protect you. Because it wouldn't have been a protection against IRS. But they said, we're going to protect you. So she says, okay, if I'm protected, put it in writing. And so then, with that kind of protection, she goes ahead and does what she thinks is wrong anyway.
That's right. And then she alleges that she was subjected
harassed
to harassment and inappropriate treatment. And that gets to the second issue, the constructive discharge issue.
Well, let's just stay with the first one. If I change this from the tax circumstances to a clear command, maybe you can put it in the commercial driving license. They tell her to drive, and she says, I don't have a license. And they say, no, you do it. And she says, if I get picked up, I'm going to get points. I'm going to get, you know, a lot of money. And they say, well, you go ahead and do it. The points we can't do anything about, but we'll pay all your fines, and et cetera. Okay? So she then says, okay, sign that. And they sign it, and now she drives, and it doesn't get caught or anything, but then they make her life heck for her. Same fact situation. Is that good enough?
It could be good enough, but in that circumstance, the law about driving without a license is more specific.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
And it's the specificity which is important in determining public policy, and it is the lack of specificity with respect to the tax laws and the facts of this case which makes it an insufficient support for a public policy exception to wrongful discharge, because it doesn't give, in the example you gave, there is a clear, specific, unambiguous directive for how a person is supposed to behave in a certain instance. And that there isn't in this case.
Yeah, but I was trying to get at whether she had to refuse or she didn't have to refuse. So it really doesn't matter if you had a clear, specific public policy.
If you have a clear, specific public policy, the refusal, in your case, the refusal, there is no refusal, but there is actually a violation of the law. In this case, there is not actually a violation of the law.
Well,
so there is
that.
Neither a refusal. Well, no, because the check was ultimately issued with the withholding.
Yeah. But we don't know whether that's was or it was not. It was a correction, maybe, and if the IRS audited, they might have been a penalty for not handling the books properly. I don't know any of that. I don't know. There is a penalty, but we don't know whether there was a violation of the law.
Correct, but that's a distinction between your example that is important,
right,
and that I was trying to point out.
What if there was not this paper? What if she simply said, no, I'm not going to do what you're asking me to do. I'm going to withhold. And then they just start making life very miserable.
Well, there's two issues on the public policy. That would satisfy one of the two issues, because one of the reasons the public policy exception cannot apply in this case is she did not refuse. So under your example, that would be a gone issue. She did refuse, and the remaining question would be whether the Internal Revenue Code is sufficiently specific of a well-defined public policy. And under the facts of this case, it's not. Pardon?
That issue would still remain.
That issue would still be there.
But if the first issue would disappear because there was a refusal, under my example, why does that piece of paper change a refusal into an acceptance? I mean, she did refuse, and that started it. And no matter what happened after that, it seems to me that if you're going to look at it from her standpoint, for purposes of the judgment, her initial refusal put Mr. Moe in the position of saying, she's a very bad, bad person, I don't want her around, and I'm going to make life miserable. I don't care what she does.
For summary judgment purposes, it does, and that leads to the second issue, and the constructive discharge, which the Court of Appeals found there are fact questions on, but they didn't decide whether a alleged constructive discharge can satisfy the involuntary termination element of at-will employment, and that's a very significant issue. If there is a public policy, then you have to look at that separate issue, and that's a very significant issue because finding constructive discharge satisfies the involuntary termination element changes the current common law of this state, because it requires an analysis of the employer's intent. The law of constructive discharge, so far in this state, is limited to contexts where the employer's conduct in creating the onerous working conditions is prescribed by statute. It's either discrimination, or it's a violation of an anti-retaliation statute, or it's a violation of a labor law. In all of those kinds of cases, the employer's intent is specifically at issue in determining a violation of the underlying statute, except in employment discrimination disparate impact cases, but I did not find any constructive discharge disparate impact cases.
So the I remember the Martin case where, I think it was a fair employment, where we talked, at least, I think I was on the court, yes, I was in 176 Wisconsin, where we talked about a employee who voluntarily quit was not entitled to reinstatement, but there we did discuss had there been constructive discharge, so we at least recognized or talked about it. But you're saying that, as I understand it, that there is no Wisconsin case that has ever allowed constructive discharge to be applied to a claim of wrongful discharge in the public policy area. That, there isn't any case out there.
There are no cases in Wisconsin.
There aren't any.
There are in other states, but not in Wisconsin.
Not in Wisconsin.
What are the other states, Hope?
Alabama, Illinois, and Virginia, and North Carolina all find that you cannot have a wrongful discharge in the context, a constructive discharge in the context of a wrongful discharge case. You must have an involuntary termination.
Well, it just doesn't make sense to me to reach that conclusion. Let me tell you why. If I want to fire somebody because I think that they're not doing what I want, and what I want is illegal or contrary to public policy. So now this court rules, well, if you fire them, you're going to be liable. But if you make life miserable, then you're not going to be liable. Well, that's easy. I mean, it's not so hard to make somebody's life miserable, I think. And they just do it like they did here. Assume, like it's alleged that they did here. And so you're doing the, you're setting up a policy, public policy that's awful for the state.
But that is the current state of the law, and we haven't had
any
problems.
We don't have any law on that in Wisconsin. There, now we have to make a choice of what kind of law is good.
It has thus far not been proscribed, and we have not had a significant problem with it. And it, to go the other way, opens up all litigation, because now you can't get rid of wrongful discharge cases on summary judgment, because constructive discharge is a fact question.
Counsel?
So what you're saying is each... Excuse me, go ahead. Just...
Counsel, in Brockmire, we indicated that we allow narrowly circumscribed public policy exceptions that properly balance the interests of employees, employers, and the public. Assume that the allegations set forth in the complaint are true. How does prohibiting the plaintiff from going forward on those allegations properly balance the interests of the public, employee, and employer? How, shorthand would be, how does your position properly balance the interests of the employee, employer, and advance the interests of the public?
One of the most significant balancing aspects is the marketplace. An employer who is a complete jerk is not going to retain employees. Going to have high turnover, he's going to have problems retaining employees, and so a failure to completely prohibit inappropriate conduct or to a law that would require civility in employment, which is a legislative issue, is through the marketplace in place.
But your argument presupposes generic jerkiness. You know, it can be that you're a jerk to one person.
Again, but that's
otherwise, you're a pretty nice person.
But that's what the law of at-will employment says. Employer can terminate somebody for any cause, good or bad.
I'm just wondering, though, so I'm interrupted you. Your balance, your position, how does it balance the interests of the employee, employer, and advanced interests of the public? And I won't interrupt you, I'm sorry.
The employer's interest is maintaining the flexibility to make personnel decisions and do things in a general context. The employee's interest is having a workplace which is free from harassment or intimidation. The public's interest in our particular facts is having taxes paid in a timely and appropriate manner. The public's general interest, the marketplace interest, is to have places of employment in which people can go and work and earn wages where they are not subjected to harassment. The balancing occurs because the marketplace factors are going to prevent employers from being jerks. The at-will employment rule allows an employer to take onerous or inappropriate actions against a particular employee, and it's not illegal unless it's prescribed otherwise by statute.
Justice
Walker. No,
that's fine. I'll get you on. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. O'Neill. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Olson, representing Ms. Strozinski.
Good afternoon. I'm Ellen Olson. I represent Kathy Strozinski. This case can be reduced down to the one unifying principle of power. This case is about an employer's power to discharge employees. Indeed, the entire doctrine of wrongful discharge is founded on power. The purpose of the doctrine is to prevent employers from misusing their power to discharge to violate public policy.
We're also talking about at will. So I agree with you that it's somewhat, yes, that you're talking about at will, where it's also the power of the employee for any reason to walk out of anybody's employment at any time. I mean, this.
Yes. Your Honor, under the doctrine of employment at will, it's undisputed.
Right.
The employee, it's an open-ended relationship. The employer has the power to discharge at any time for any reason. And of course, we've carved out exceptions.
Yep.
There are the statutory exceptions, and we have this wrongful discharge doctrine we're dealing with today. Now, this wrongful discharge doctrine focuses on the misuse of the employer's power to discharge an employee in violation of public policy. This power principle was emphasized in the concurring opinion of Bushko. There, Justice Abramson asked us to suppose that there was no express command by the employer to violate public policy, but there was either an expectation, a policy, or an intent that the employee, in that case, would reimburse the employer for customer stolen checks, and that if the employee did not reimburse the employer for the stolen checks, the employee would be terminated. We were asked to suppose further that the employee, in fact, did not reimburse for the stolen checks, and as a result, the employee was terminated. In that opinion, it was stated that whether the command is express or implied is not the determining factor in a wrongful discharge action. And I believe that was also articulated in Houseman, that we need not have an affirmative command by the employer to sustain a wrongful discharge cause of action where there's an affirmative legal obligation imposed on the employee.
But that situation isn't analogous to what you have here, is it? Because the problem was over and done with. Right,
here we have better facts in that we have this express command by the employer.
But it didn't, I mean, it was all solved and over and done with at the point.
Well, it really wasn't.
It had been several weeks at the point that she left, right?
Well, there was a sequence of events where there were numerous checks that were created. There were attempts by management to manipulate the software and create new checks and change the amount of the withholding. A continuation of this command that she violate the law. But my point is that this principle of power or this concern that the employer will...
So you're indicating, just so I understand, your
yes.
opposing counsel said, well, wait a minute, looking at either 943.39 or the Internal Revenue Code 6672.3101 or 3102, that it is not implicit, it is not so obvious that she was going to be violating the law. In fact, as I understand the facts and I read the appendix here, that your client called the IRS and said, yes, you should do this, but you should have Mr. Moe call us. Mr. Moe, this is a, so you have an understanding or misunderstanding. Mr. Moe then called and he came back, as I, according to the facts here, and said, yes, I guess you have to take some out of my check, but I would like you to do it this way because I don't have, you know, I don't have the money. So it was like a $700 withdrawal all at once out of the first check after the TSA payment. I mean, the one that went into Janice.
Well, the sequence was a little bit different than that.
Okay.
There was a refusal by Ms. Brzezinski to issue the check. She called the IRS.
Now, when you say issue the check, let me... Did she sign these checks?
I believe that they were run through a software program where she didn't actually physically sign those with a pen, but she was the individual who was responsible for issuing the checks.
Somebody else signed the check.
I believe that's true.
And her responsibility as a payroll clerk was to get the checks out on time and to issue them. And she worked for Mr. Amundson, and he's the one that, Amundson was her immediate supervisor.
Immediate supervisor, the chain of command then was that Amundson reported to Mr. Moe,
yes.
The individual who wanted the check without the withholding.
Yes.
With respect to this issue regarding her responsibility, is she a responsible person under the IRS code? I'm certainly not a tax lawyer, and when this case came to me, the first thing I did was pick up the phone and I called a tax expert, a partner at the Reinhardt firm.
Now, is this in that record?
It's in the record.
Okay.
It's in the summary judgment record. First of all, on that issue, for purposes of summary judgment, the Bronger School District assumed that it was covered. And the 943.39 does not distinguish between corporations which are governmental corporations and private corporations, number one. But then beyond that, we have an expert opinion in the record that Ms. Brzezinski was a responsible person as defined by the code, and we cited case law from the Fifth Circuit and other case law that she would indeed be held responsible. Attorney Nettesheim, our expert, also opined that he would never, ever instruct a client to utilize the defense that the petitioner is asserting here to try to protect a client, that person ultimately could be held responsible even though they're in a clerical position if they are the person who's issuing the check and responsible for making the accurate calculation. The importance of the concurring opinion in Bushko and that analysis regarding no distinction between a constructive a direct express command and an implied command is that we need to apply that same analysis to the discharge itself. Whether the discharge is through an express command by the employer or it is constructed by the employer by creating intolerable work conditions, the result is ultimately the same. And that should not be the determining factor. Indeed, the unifying principle of the Brockmeyer Doctrine is that the employer may not use the power to discharge to undermine a public policy. And that misuse of power is no less effective in a case where the employer expressly discharges the employee by uttering the words, "you're fired," in comparison to engaging in conduct which creates intolerable work conditions and forces a reasonable employee to flee the workplace.
In this case, she gave 2 weeks' notice, as I recall.
Correct.
And then terminated her employment in September. This incident started in July, which was during the off-school time.
Yes.
And that's when he, Superintendent Bowe, received his so-called bonus, or his $9,100 bonus.
Yes. And then we know from the facts that Ms. Straczynski took off the day after the incident to calm down, and then she went on a pre-scheduled vacation for 1 week. Then she came back in, and that was the quiet time. She didn't have a lot of direct interaction with Mr. Moll, but she reported directly to her supervisor. Every time she saw him walking down the hall, her stomach would flip-flop. She was very anxious. There was an exchange between she and Mr. Amundson about maybe she was working for the wrong guy. If she thought that was pressure, they were taking away her work duties.
Now, I don't want to say that happens in many work situations, but when you say that it could even happen up here or in any trial court or any place, that the work conditions could be considered not ideal. The thing is that what I want to get at is that you have an at-will situation, and we look at this in the light of what a reasonable person, not necessarily your client, and you
Absolutely.
Make that point. You make that point in your brief.
Yes.
And what I'm concerned or thinking about is when a person quits, and maybe they quit for a variety of reasons. One is that their stomach is flip-flopping and they don't like Miss So-and-so or Miss... it seems to me this is going to open up this area to a great deal of potential litigation, because you can always claim, and my facts are a little different than your facts. I mean, talking about the difference between you and opposing counsel and what exactly happened, and all you want to do is get to the jury based upon a, quote, constructive discharge, which the state has never at least recognized before.
That's true. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has not recognized it to date, but by recognizing it, we in no way would change the process. We do not open the floodgates to litigation.
And why is that? Why don't we?
Because the analysis is the same. It's still an issue of law as to whether there is a clear mandate of public policy identified, correct? And then ultimately a factual issue as to whether the employee was discharged in violation of that public policy or for refusing to violate a clear mandate of public policy. The only remaining issue is whether the employee was terminated, and that's a fact issue anyway.
But isn't there some disconnect here between this whole public policy argument involving whether or not there should have been withholding on this check and the reasons for her departure? For voluntary departure?
Under the facts of our case?
I mean, there's a disconnect there between the theory of constructive discharge and the wrongful discharge for, against the public policy clearly defined, et cetera, et cetera. Do you see what I'm saying? The facts of your case. There's
yes.
a dispute over the check and whether there should have been withholding, and that's how you're getting to your public policy argument here. But that's not why she left. She didn't leave over that. She left because of the working conditions, right?
No, there's a very direct connection, and that is a requirement of the...
This is summary judgment. Isn't that a decision for the jury?
Ultimately, it would be a decision for the jury
as to whether there's a connect or not.
Correct. Whether the work conditions are intolerable. Is there a connect? And here we have an express command by the employer to violate the law. The employee refuses. The employer begins to retaliate, takes away job duties, and we go down the list of facts that we have.
But it may be that she just doesn't like them. I mean, who would like somebody that screams and yells and behaves badly? And now she really doesn't like them. She doesn't like the whole environment. And it may or may not have anything to do that they've intentionally and deliberately attempting to get her to quit so that they're not liable for firing her. I mean, but that's not before us, is it?
Well, it's not before us, and that is a case that would not pass muster under the constructive discharge analogy.
Right, but that would be for the jury.
Analysis, rather. That's for the jury to decide whether it was the employer that created intolerable work conditions as a result of the employee's refusal to violate public policy.
Is that a good policy to have these questions go to the jury? I mean, so you get the jury gets a, having been a trial judge for a number of years, the jury always gets two sides, A and
yes.
B, and so then they make a judgment. And it just seems to me from a public policy standpoint, is this something that you want to go to the jury to be deciding this particular issue?
Well, I believe it is a fact-intensive inquiry, and it's something appropriately decided by the jury, considered
by
the jury.
That's why I asked you, excuse me, about opening up a lot of litigation, because it seems to me that when you have a resignation, and I'm not saying that this wasn't an egregious, and in an appropriate case, and maybe not appropriate, but you could have people, everybody thinks that they may have been abused, flip-flopping of the stomach, very intolerable working conditions, and what I think what you're saying is that there's enough here to get by summary judgment, you have material facts and issue, and then you go to the jury. I'm not sure that that is, that doesn't eviscerate in some way the at-will employment, which the idea is that both sides are free to discharge or to stay.
Well,
just asking you if, when you say you don't think that this would be just carving out a narrow exception, well, we have carved out several narrow exceptions from the at-will employment since I've been on the board. And this would be one more, but it kind of seems to be open-ended, and that's what is concerning me.
Well, Your Honor, if there are, first of all, a client bringing this kind of a case to a plaintiff's lawyer, that lawyer and the client are not going to pursue the claim if there are very weak facts connecting the discharge, the intolerable, so-called intolerable work conditions, with the refusal to violate public policy. If there, for example, if there is a long period of time, there's one case in a different context, a Title VII case, where there was a span of perhaps 2 years that occurred between the date of the protected activity and the date of the constructive discharge. There was no connection there, ultimately, the jury found. I don't believe this opens up or eviscerates the wrongful discharge doctrine. It simply acknowledges that an employer cannot escape liability by simply engaging in a campaign of conduct that will create intolerable working conditions and constructively discharge that employee instead of simply uttering the words, "You're fired."
Do I understand your argument to be this? Because I can certainly appreciate it, but Justice Wilcox's question, and it's consistent with a lot of courts emphasize in their opinions that frustrations and tensions can be a part of any job, and that that's inherent in many, many workplaces. But what I understand you to be asking and saying is this. Look, take a look at Kempfer. Kempfer said, narrowly circumscribed public policy to employment at will provides that employer may not discharge employee for refusing command to violate fundamental and well-defined public policy. What I hear you arguing is you want us to insert the word to that Kempfer holding, that an employer may not constructively discharge, and then the case should be sent to the jury to determine whether or not what happened here factually constitutes a constructive discharge. That's what I understand your argument to be. Am I correct or not correct?
Well, ultimately, as good lawyers, I think we need to be very specific and lay that out exactly and lay out that roadmap for all litigants in the future. The Court of Appeals sort of glossed over that. I think for a lot of people...
Am I correct or am I incorrect?
I think you're correct, Your Honor. And
not all you want. I mean, you're asking us, let's put it right on the table.
Yes.
You're asking us to really recognize a cause of action for constructive discharge in this state.
I only take issue with the use of your terminology. I do not want to imply that we're looking to create a generic cause of action called constructive discharge. That, for purposes of this analysis, a constructive discharge will satisfy the termination element of a wrongful discharge claim.
That's exactly it. That's a great correction for you to make, because I was too loose. What you're asking is that, as I started out before with Kempfer, narrowly circumscribed public policy exception to employment at will provides that employer may not constructively discharge employee for refusing command to violate fundamental and well-defined policy. That's what you're asking.
Yes, it is.
Now, why is that good public policy in light of a concept of opening the floodgates of litigation?
As you had pointed out in the prior argument, the employer could very easily, once they get the message that they are prohibited from an express discharge but they're permitted to constructively discharge, simply make that employee's life miserable. And in order to hold up this public policy, and looking at the big picture here, I mean, the foundation of this doctrine is to make sure that employers do not misuse their power to discharge. And whether the command comes from an express command or it's implied, or whether the discharge is express or it is constructed through intolerable conduct, we still need to look at the underlying purpose of that doctrine, and that is only satisfied if we recognize the doctrine of constructive discharge.
Recognize or extend? I thought we recognized it in Martin.
Well, we've recognized it certainly in other contexts, but never before has this court scrutinized this issue in the context of a wrongful discharge action.
Counsel, I found the arguments of Ms. O'Brien with respect to... that she raised, I mean, public policy, whether there was really sufficient...
Ms. O'Neill, it's O'Neill. Okay.
Didn't I say Ms. O'Neill?
No.
You said O'Brien.
O'Brien.
Oh!
It's because I'm wearing green.
It's our last oral argument. I found that somewhat persuasive. Can you respond to that?
Yes. The four code sections, three federal and one state, each impose an affirmative duty on the employee to correctly report in documents and in particular in tax records. It covers not only affirmative fraudulent writings, but also omissions. The employee, the responsible person, cannot omit information, for example, omit withholdings.
What, Michael?
And it's not just a paper distinction. Yes.
I'm sorry, you were answering each other.
It's not just a paper distinction. We've got the underlying public policy. The government needs this money to survive. And that's the reason we withhold that. There are people who rely on that.
Less government, better.
Isn't the point, could they have withheld this later on? I mean, as I understand the facts, in 93, they did what Mr. Moe proposed. In 94, they did the same thing. But in 95, your client then withheld. And so it was paid in 94, I assume. It was paid in 93, I assume, and those were the facts. In other words, there was a change of policy by your client. Now, what you're, I fail to see, and we're talking about fraudulent, false claims, etc. I'm not sure if it rises to that particular level. That's what I think Justice Babbage was asking.
Looking at all the facts surrounding this, in reality what happened was when Ms. Straczynski came into the department, she had been warned by prior bookkeepers that there are things happening in the books here that you have to be careful about. There are some improper practices here. After that, she attended a bookkeepers association seminar. There she learned about being personally held liable for failing to withhold taxes.
Well, counsel, I can get back to that question. Just to get it clarified, what particular words are you relying on in the IRC 3101 and 3102, 6672, that you say is so clear?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, this is no less clear than the legislation. Yes, the legislation in the Houseman decision, which imposed penalties on the employee for failing to.
Also, you're making an argument to me right now. Right now, I just want to know what
sure.
words you're relying on.
If I can put my hands on it, thank you, Counsel. There are penalty provisions set forth in the statute. The responsible person can be held liable. I don't want to make argument, but beyond that, then I go into this Houseman analysis, that if there's.
So those are the only words you're relying on?
Do you have those statutes
in
your.
I do, yes.
I have seen them.
Well, number one, 3101 says that the tax.
Where is it, counsel? Is it
okay, in the very first line.
I'm sorry.
I do not have the code section set out in full. There are only excerpts in the argument section of the briefs.
Right. Well, if you could refer me to those pages.
I can refer you actually to the code section 3102. In the very first line, it says the tax imposed by Section 3101 shall be collected by the employer of the taxpayer by deducting the amount of the tax from the wages as and when paid. There's an affirmative duty that tax shall be collected.
Well, 6672 is on page 30. Any person required to collect, truthfully account for, and pay over any tax imposed by this title who willfully fails to collect such tax or truthfully account for and pay over such tax or willfully attempts in any manner evade or defeat shall, in addition to other penalties, be liable to a penalty equal to the total amount of the tax evaded or not collected. And you're saying that she was required to collect, and if she didn't, it would be untruthful.
Correct. And she's subject to these penalties if she did not.
Okay, so that's 6672A. That's the specific language you're relying on next.
Yes, Your Honor.
You wouldn't characterize, and I'm just, you don't think there was a disagreement about what the law required here? In other words, you had a superintendent, you had a supervisor, Mr. Amundson, who said, no, that's not the way we've been doing it. The taxes have been collected. This was a disagreement between three people, as I understand it. And then the number two person signed, well, I'll be responsible for this, because that was Amundson signing that so-called release before your client issued the check.
If you're asking what I think,
I'm characterizing this as a disagreement between people as to how this withholding should take place.
And
if that's a mischaracterization, tell me why it is.
Yes, it's a mischaracterization. I think the facts indicate that Mr. Moll did what he did as long as he could get away with it, and a smart bookkeeper like Ms. Straczynski came along. She knew what her responsibilities were. She took the high road. She was honest. She did everything she could to comply with the law, and then she was retaliated against in response. That's exactly what our doctrine of wrongful discharge in Wisconsin seeks to protect against.
And eventually, but the reason I characterize it that way, eventually Mr. Moll, as you pointed out, called the IRS. They said, yes, you should do it, and he came back and said, yes, you should do this.
Facts are slightly different than that. Actually, Mr. Moll contacted his own legal counsel. It was not to the IRS, and then he came back. This is at least what he reported to Ms. Trzynski, reported that he learned that he was indeed required to take the withholding, and that's when they went in and the real pressure was put on to try to manipulate the software. So it was not a red flag for the IRS. He said, well, I don't want to take out all of the Social Security, let's just take out part of it. There was a safety mechanism in the software that did not allow that to happen. No matter how much Mr. Amundson and Mr. Moll tried over and over and over again to have Ms. Brzezinski manipulate the software to take less of a deduction.
So what were they done, taking the deduction over two or three paychecks? Or they just weren't going to withhold all of it?
I don't know that we ever learned those facts as to what the exact intent was there, other than he didn't want that big tax hit on that one particular check.
Well, you knew that in 93 and 94 they had done it this quote other way. So isn't that correct?
Yes. And in the meantime, Ms. Strzynski went to the seminar. She had spoken to an individual accountant, and she learned more about what her legal responsibilities were.
Apparently she was right.
Yes. According to our tax expert, she was exactly right.
Is there any evidence that Mr. Moll did not make the withholding tax payments at some point in prior years?
We have no information or facts other than what prior bookkeepers have said about improprieties in the bookkeeping. As to whether he had actually ultimately withheld the taxes, I don't know that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. O'Neill, also known as Ms. O'Brien.
As long as it's Irish. This is not a case where you're being asked to carve out another public policy exception. You're being asked to change the basic at-will employment law. You're being asked to change it to interject a rule of civility in employment. And rulemaking in terms of what an employer can or cannot do is a role for the legislature. The request that the respondent is making is that you essentially do agree to open the floodgates of litigation. The public policy concern the respondent cites is, well, if you rule for the petitioner, you're sending a message to employers that as long as you don't fire anybody, you can get away with a lot of things. To rule for the respondent, you're sending the same kind of a message to the employee. You can quit, and then you can get that discharge looked at to see whether you were constructively discharged, because you have a fact question. Because constructive discharge is a fact question. And as this court noted in Bushko, if we were going to look at intent on summary judgment, you'd never get a wrongful discharge action dismissed.
Counsel, you work for a big law firm. Assume that your supervising employer directed you to change billing records to do something that clearly was wrong. Respectability, and you wouldn't do it. As your relationship with your former mentor turned 180 degrees, and instead of being supportive, he was absolutely underwhelmed. And instead of helping you with your career with other people, he was doing everything he could to sabotage your career.
giving you dog cases.
Giving you real dog instead of important cases like this. Essentially, you started to insist that instead of the $2,200 hours a year that you're billing, you could come in with $2,600. And constant pressure on you to the point where you simply couldn't handle it anymore. And clearly, this was unreasonable. So you leave. And although, are you saying that you would not have an action for wrongful discharge?
Yes. I would not have an action for wrongful discharge. Mm-hmm. I could dig in and put up with it and see if I could change it. Of course, that would never happen at my law firm. But if it did, I could dig in and see if I could change it. Or I could leave. That's my choice. But I would not have an action for wrongful discharge.
Well, that's quite a choice. But what if you had a family of, I don't know, maybe you do, family of six to feed, and three of them are in law school. I mean, your economic consequences are such that you really... are totally dependent upon this job.
That assumes that there are no other jobs out there, but assuming that that would be true, it would be a more difficult choice, but I also have the choice to stay, hang in there, to try and do it, to talk to other people, to see if there's another way around it, to see if it changes. And to rule otherwise is to allow the law and juries to look at the reasons for discharge. And then to look at the reasonableness of the decision. I mean, maybe there is a partner that I don't like to work for. Maybe he does make me nervous. Maybe he makes everybody nervous.
Yeah, but he didn't ask you to cheat on your billing.
I'm sorry?
He didn't ask you to cheat on your billing. This is the important thing. It's not merely civility in the workplace. It's lack of civility combined with if you accept, which you don't have to. That is a violation of asking to violate rules that will make you lose your license, perhaps, if reported.
That's true, but that's if that's true. And to get to a jury, all I have to do is allege that happened.
You're in the jury business. Why are you so concerned about having a trial? That's what we're paid to do, have trials. Why don't you have a trial? Why do you need everything on summary judgment? Like 80% of the cases are now handled on summary judgment. It's okay to have a trial. It's not against public policy to have a trial.
No, as a trial lawyer,
juries are okay.
I think it's good to have trials. But I think too many cases are settled.
So what are we so concerned about that you're not going to get a summary judgment?
Because now you wait a year, approximately, to go to trial in state court. And in federal court, unless you're in Judge Shabazz's court, you wait about 14 months. And if you allow all these trials, you'll wait years.
So what? She's not. Then it's better not to get paid at all and not have a trial? I mean, at least with a trial, she stands the chance of getting some money.
She does, and that's one of the issues which needs to be balanced, is what this is going to do to the court's calendars and balancing it against the right to have a trial, because you're right, every person has a right to trial.
Can I ask a question? Following up, if I may, on Justice Babbage's hypothetical, if you were asked and pressured by a supervising attorney to falsify your billing records, you balked or didn't want to or didn't, and he fired you, would you have a cause of action in Wisconsin?
I might, and I'm not answering that to be equivocal. I might. It would depend on how he was asked, what he asked me to do. If it was something that was clearly in violation of the rules of public policy, yes.
How could you state your bills?
Yes,
double them.
Yes, if he asked me to double my bills, yes, I might.
Okay. You would have a cause of action.
I would think that I would have a cause of action, yes.
And then he fired you.
Yeah, he fired you and you have a cause of action. There's an argument that by not recognizing constructive discharge, you're allowing someone to do through the back door what they couldn't do in the front door.
There is an argument, but it is a balancing argument, and we submit that the balance has to fall in the favor of at-will employment, because otherwise you take away the employer's rights to have flexibility. And the employer, it might be a timing issue. I might quit after that and claim constructive discharge and claim it was because he asked me to do that. But really what happened was that I went to vacation in Acapulco and didn't tell anybody, and I blew an appeal deadline for a major client. But now I have a jury trial.
There are fines against you, then.
Your main argument, the one you started out with, is that we just don't have a well-defined public policy dealing with the IRS code.
Yes, that is my main argument.
Thank you, Ms. O'Neill. Thank you, Mr. Olson. That concludes the hearing on 980454. Would you approach the bench, please, both of you?
Thank you.